This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.
Now we speak with the New York Assembly member Charles Barron on a revolutionary perspective on why we must engage in electoral politics. Assemblymember Barron has described his own role in the Assembly not simply to try to pass innovative proposals or conduct rigorous oversight, which he does, but to first and foremost advocate and agitate as loudly and clearly as possible for our side in the struggle, the side of the exploited and oppressed. Charles Barron, thanks for joining us.
What is a revolutionary perspective, your perspective, on why to engage in electoral politics?
When you study revolutions around the world, whether it was the Cuban Revolution when Fidel Castro ran for Congress before they had to go into the hills and deal with guerrilla warfare, or whether it was the Sandinistas and their revolutionary struggle, armed struggle, but when they came out of the bush, they had to deal in the electoral arena. Even Hamas, the struggling organization in Palestine, first they weren't engaged in the electoral arena, and then they decided to go into the electoral arena and actually win in free and fair elections on the Gaza Strip. Of course, in South Africa, it's a one person, one vote. I don't know of too many struggles, revolutionary struggles in the world, the African continent, where Kwame Nkrumah, Sekou Touré, and Julius Nyerere, and Patrice Lumumba, electoral politics, they had to deal with state power and develop parties that would engage in the electoral arena. Robert Mugabe in Zimbabwe, you know, the opposition was funded by American and British imperialism, but it was in the electoral arena. The Black Panther Party in 1973, Bobby Seale, he ran for mayor of Oakland, came pretty close. He got 30-40% of the vote, and Elaine Brown ran for the city council in Oakland. She got 35,000 votes, but they turned it into a citywide race, and she didn't get the victory. But it's always been a part of the struggle. We had a black political convention in Gary, Indiana in 1972. Over 10,000-12,000 people from the black community that came in, and from conservatives, to Republicans, Democrats, and socialists, Marxists, revolutionary nationalists, black nationalists, everybody came together to deal with this whole idea of political power. Out of that was supposed to be an independent political party, but basically what happened out of that, a lot of the black radicals went back to our struggles as we moved them forward. And then the neoliberal, more conservatives, they got into the electoral arena, and a lot of them got elected. We went from about 2,000-3,000 black elected officials prior to the convention to about 7,000 after the convention, shortly thereafter. And there's about 13,000 elected officials now, black elected officials in the United States. However, we suffer from a more sinister kind of colonialism and oppression, and that's called neocolonialism. And the new way to colonize is to put black faces in high places, supply them with resources as long as they can be maintained under the control of the colonial capitalist system and its imperialistic foreign policy. So we said one of the best ways to combat that in our local communities is to build a black radical revolutionary electoral movement so that we can get into the electoral arena and deal with city and state power and resources. One of the real challenges of our revolutionary movement is resources. Amilcar Cabral, the great liberator, revolutionary from Guinea-Bissau, said, bear in mind the masses is not fighting for ideas in your mind. They're fighting for material benefits and a future for their children. So mask no difficulties, tell no lies, and claim no easy victories. With that kind of ideology and philosophy, we in Operation Power in my beloved East New York thought it would be good if we can get involved in the electoral arena to do two things. One, to get some goods and services and material benefits for our people, and we did that. We got affordable housing, over 12,000 units, and my 60th, and Inez's, my wife, is the city council member, Inez Barron's 42nd council district. We got over 12,000 units of affordable housing, as we define affordability, to the income of the people in our district. And we stopped gentrification. There is no gentrification in the 60th Assembly District and the 42nd Council District. It does not exist. We did not pass for one market rate apartment in our district. And that happened because of power. The power of the city council to determine what's going to be built on city-owned land. And then we have new schools and develop new parks, five new parks over $20, $30 million, and a new state-of-the-art $12 million two-story youth community center where the young people are employed in it to run it. Magnificent gymnasium and culinary arts class and computers and everything you think of it, we got it. All of this happened because we had access to that in the electoral arena. But the second piece is we don't just want to render and get material benefits for our people. We want to talk revolution, radical consciousness. And they hear you more when you created 2,000 jobs, $50 million worth of CUNY scholarships, and all the other things I just mentioned. They have a more open ear to revolutionary ideology, because no movement is going to advance without a serious ideological proponent to it. It's like flying a plane without radar. You won't know where you're landing. So you need to have an ideology and a vision when you engage in movements. And then we were able to highlight the contradictions in the colonial capitalist system by interrupting the governor at his state of the state address and calling him out and fighting with mayors and speakers. And we did all of that, not hiding that we believe in revolution and socialism leading toward even communism. We believe in a form of African communalism, and we say no to imperialism and its wars. We said all of this, not just at our conferences and in our quarters, but we said this on the floor of the city council and in the chambers of the state assembly. So to raise that kind of revolutionary consciousness when you're in an electoral arena, you have that kind of platform to be able to do that by way of the different forms of media, mass media, social media, and the mass line approach, just pressing the flesh and talking to the people. So that is a value, and we know we cannot vote our way to freedom. We cannot vote our way to a radical revolution, but it is a, not a panacea, a tactic, and it has worked for us tremendously.
You brought up something that is particularly close to my heart, which is the issue of a shelter poor society and the imperative as part of the human condition for people to have a place to live and to have a decent place to live and a place that is affordable, notwithstanding that I unequivocally believe in housing in the public domain. Otherwise, we are not there yet. But what I want to ask you about is, as we are on the precipice in New York of massive evictions, which were certainly in the pipeline before, but were exacerbated by virtue of COVID and the loss of income and livelihood. And here we are with a governor who has this national empathetic seeming image of someone who is a friend of the people, fighting aggressively for protocols to damp down the worst parts of the contagion and to develop a way of ultimately thwarting the coronavirus. Now, with that being said, we are, again, about to commence on massive evictions in the court systems directly related to, as I said, COVID and the fact that we don't have a society that sees shelter as a human right but prefers to see it as an asset for the profitability of realtors, a way to make one's profit. So with that, translate a revolutionary approach into the assembly and talk about where we are with something as elementary as providing housing for the people. And no doubt in your district, East New York, which is one of the third poorest in the city, there will be tremendous evictions. So how do we reconcile your positioning as a revolutionary legislator with the reality of where the governor is at, where the assembly isn't at this juncture?
Well, first, let me tell you, the biggest con job in America has been delivered by Andrew Cuomo. The biggest con job on dealing with this pandemic has been fronted by Andrew Cuomo. Had the nerve to write a book about it and sending that all over the place. First of all, New York City and New York State was the epicenter of the pandemic, and yet we weren't the most populous state in the union. California was, but yet we had the most those who diagnosed with the COVID virus. Also, this governor had the nerve to say that nursing homes, the most vulnerable of those in the population to the virus, had to take coronavirus-infected patients because he wanted to get as many of them out of the hospitals as possible and make more beds for others. He should have been arrested for that alone because of the deaths that occurred because of his order to force nursing homes to take COVID-affected patients. This governor then, after all of the studies showed that the most people who died most was black and brown people. 55-60% of the people that died were in black and brown communities. And because of the colonial exploitative condition of our community, we had the highest rates of everything. It wasn't just our pre-health condition. It was our pre-capitalist exploitive condition where we had the most poverty, the most imprisoned, the least amount of quality health care and housings and all of that. That made us more vulnerable to the virus. And in that, when a ship was brought to New York to put 1,000 beds in, that went to the white community under Cuomo's reign. Javits Center was turned into a hospital like in the white community. Central Park was turned into a medical facility in the white community. We had to kick, scratch, bite, wolf, do everything to get them to finally, him and de Blasio, to finally focus on where the people were dying and affected most in the black community. That happened months later, after scores of people dying. And I put that blood, that death, on Cuomo and de Blasio. When it came to housing, we were fighting in the assembly not just for a moratorium on eviction. We don't want you to delay inevitable if people don't have money to pay their rent. We're fighting with the federal government to get money, and Trump's federal government gave New York State Cuomo $5 billion. We, some of us progressives in the state assembly and the state said $1 billion of that to go for rent relief and pay the entire rent of those who lost their jobs, of those who are low income and fixed income or whatever, who were facing evictions, not just a moratorium on the eviction, but rent relief. And we said we should put in the bill that the landlord, after a certain period, cannot raise rent and cannot evict, even if they owed more, for the duration of the pandemic. Well, this governor offered a measly $39 million for rent relief. We needed $1 billion. The assembly, under Carl Hayce, he said, all right, let's do $500 million. I was not even for that. We should have stuck with the billion. Then it finally went down to $100 million for this program. It was in my committee, the Housing Committee, the $100 million. We got enough of us who were progressive and organized, and we said, no, we're voting no for that bill, and not until you go back up to $1 billion. Carl Hayce, knowing he didn't have the votes in the Housing Committee that the bill was in, took it out of the Housing Committee, put it in the Ways and Means Committee, and had it voted out that way. And that's why so many, millions, so many of our people didn't get a penny toward the rent. And also in this bill, it still had the renters paying 30 to 40, 50% of their income toward rent, and the landlords would get the rest from the state. So the only people that benefited out of this were the landlords. And the poor people that couldn't afford the rent will still owe after this is all over with. This is the kind of government that needs radical change, and I resent the fact that too many of our black and brown elected officials voted for this bill and voted for this budget, where this governor cut $2.5 billion from Medicaid during the pandemic and cut $400 million from hospitals during the pandemic. And we were able to muster up 17 people to vote against it, 17 Democrats, because the Republicans always vote against their bills. We were 5 votes short of defeating this budget that didn't put the $400 million back in for NYCHA, capital money, that didn't have anything for poverty and cut Medicaid, cut hospitals. That's what these black and Latinos voted for, except there's about 17 of us who didn't, and many of them were blacks and Latinos, but too many of us did vote. This is how terrible this governor was, and that's why all the people died that didn't have to die. Had they prioritized where the death was occurring the highest in black and brown communities, and if they would have protected the nursing home elderly from this kind of virus. He's a hypocrite.
I just want to switch for a moment to what we certainly understand is the reality, no matter who's in office, and that is the imperative to keep boots on the ground. The people must always have a groundswell to, no matter who is in office, have their voices heard, to keep the pressure on, to have themselves felt as the mass presence that they must be to influence the circumstance of their lives, because that is the fundamental way, notwithstanding the electoral arena, that we understand that empowerment accomplished historically. And having said that, I wonder how you analyze the period and the import of Black Lives Matter, which moved from a hashtag to a mighty cry against white supremacy in the world. Your thoughts about Black Lives Matter, as somebody who's been part of the revolutionary struggle for when it also had the initials BLM at an earlier point, which was Black Liberation Movement.
Well, there's a big difference between the Black Liberation Movement, Black Panthers, and these kinds of movements in the 60s and the Black Lives Matter movement. We were more ideologically sound, and we were more organizing for power, and we have to go beyond mobilizing around a singular issue, police brutality as severe as it is, and move to organizing for power. But that movement did create an atmosphere now where people are ready all across the country and all across the world. They're ready for radical change, systemic change. We cannot continue to organize around symptomology, the symptoms of a fatally flawed, racist, parasitic, colonial, capitalist system is poverty. That's a symptom. Unemployment is a symptom. Mass incarceration is a symptom. Homelessness is a symptom. Inadequate health care is a symptom. So if we continue to argue and fight around these symptoms, and we must, without getting to the root causes of the problem, which is capitalism and its racist ideology. We even have to watch out when we're fighting against racism, because then some people might say, well, the answer is diversity, inclusion. Inclusion into this system? No. We want revolution, radical systemic change of the system, a dismantling of the colonial capitalist system, not just to be included in it. Well, they'll give you a president even. There'll be 13,000 Black elected officials. They'll even pass some ineffective criminal justice legislation. We can now get the background for police, okay? We have a chokehold bill. Well, the police policy was always against the chokehold ever since they choked, you know, Arthur Miller in 1978. And after that, choked great artists who was in the subways, and choked Michael Stewart in the subways. They choked him to death, and also choked his poor football, hit the car, and Anthony Baez was choked. And, of course, Eric Garner was choked. All of this was when the chokehold was against police policy. So none of these bills really effectively changed anything, but that's what they gave us. So, and during this more radical time, it's time for radical solutions. So I say that we should not just look at personalities when it comes to presidential politics. We should look at the fact that we're dealing with a social, economic, and political structure called capitalism, and that this has created imperialistic wars abroad, and this has created poverty in our communities, created a wealth gap, an income gap, and all of that is created by this two-party, not one party, this two-party capitalist system. So we have to keep our people focused that we need a revolution and a radical change. So, yes, vote. Make sure you vote on a local level to do what we did in East New York. Vote for people who have your politics, have your ideology, have your best interest at heart on a local level so you can make the changes, because revolution will occur from the bottom up. On the presidential level in New York, Biden is going to win, just like I knew Hillary would win. We're going to have to really organize, because I do believe he's going to win, and I do believe people are so Trumpetized that they're going to be glad just to see Trump go dance in the streets. But my concern is that the pressure may not be put on as strong as it is now, because Biden is going to win, I believe. I would be shocked if he loses, but I was wrong before. I didn't think Trump was going to beat Hillary, so don't pay me no mind. But I think that... I'm concerned that the struggle will not be as strong, just like it wasn't under Obama. Obama didn't even do well by Black colleges and Black farmers, much less anything else. So Biden wins. That's going to be our greatest challenge, because people are going to be dancing in the street, and Trump will eventually leave no matter what craziness he's threatening and going through. So we got to stay focused on local politics with Black radicals, revolutionary, being elected on a local level to impact city councils and state assemblies. We have a state budget of $170 plus billion, a nearly $90 billion-dollar city budget, there should be no poverty in New York. None. There shouldn't be any homelessness in New York. But it is because of the local politics. And all politics is local, and we need to start from the bottom up. That's how revolution starts, not from Biden down. That's not going to happen. After the 3rd, on the 4th, let's really get busy and step to Biden. They still have sanctions on Zimbabwe. We need to fight against that. Sanctions in Cuba and Venezuela, we need to fight against those things. There is so much we need to battle Biden on. And I want you to go to sleep after the victory, because his win is not a win for us. It's still a win for capitalism, imperialism, it's wars abroad, and it's poverty domestically.
So what I wonder, if you could give us two sentences and promise to come back, relevant thereto, to discuss your new book, which should be out in a couple of weeks, but two sentences to preview that book and, again, the promise to come back and discuss it with us.
Well, thank you so much. In the two sentences, the name of the book, Speaking Truth to Power. That's the name of the book. It's a compilation of 80 articles I've written over the years. It's articles on revolution, articles on my experiences in the city council and in the state assembly, articles on leadership and reparations and political prisoners. And by the way, real quickly, we were able to get Jalil Montecum, Anthony Bottom, out as a political prisoner. We got Herman Bell out as a political prisoner. We got Seth Hayes out as a political prisoner. And all three of them, I was able to get a letter of support from the 60-plus members of the Black, Latino, and Asian caucus in the state assembly. And that was a major accomplishment. So the book will cover all of that stuff, and I'm so excited that I got it done, and it'll be out in 2 weeks. Speaking Truth to Power.
And you are going to come back and discuss it with us, right?
Yep. Oh, love to. I would love to. Thank you so much, Mimi.
My revolutionary comrade, Saul Barron, thank you for the position that you have taken and your role these many years in the electoral arena and showing us the path about why the electoral arena is most definitively an arrow in our quiver, a tool to use to empower the people and to make a better world possible. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We've been speaking with this New York Assembly member, Charles Barron.
You've been listening to Building Bridges, produced by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. Stay strong and stay well.